This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll talk with Diane Ravitch. Her book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Diane Ravitch, former Assistant Secretary of Education under President Bush, #2. Also, Lisa Guernsey, her book is Screen Time, How Electronic Media from Baby Videos to Educational Software Affects Your Young Child. And we'll talk with Scott Wilfong, the political consultant from the right, who is assessing the U.S. Senate race with Bill Cassidy and Rob Manus running from the right against Mary Landrieu. The election now is getting closer. November 3rd is 7 weeks away. We'll talk about it with Scott Wilfong. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757. Our leadoff guest for the week is Diane Ravitch. She is one of the foremost authorities on education in the United States, a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education, and she is taking a comprehensive look at today's American school system in her latest work, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Good morning, Diane.
Well, good morning, Jim. Good to be back with you.
Well, good to hear your voice again. Why is the privatization movement, as you call it, why is it such a danger?
Well, it's a danger because one of the most important institutions in a democratic society is a free public school system, supported by the public, supported by tax dollars, open to everybody without lotteries. And what is happening now in Louisiana is I'd say, kind of a ground zero for this, is an effort to turn public dollars over to private entrepreneurs to run schools. Also, the use of vouchers so that children can go to religious schools. Now, I'm not opposed to religious schools, but I think people should send their kids there and pay for it. As you've seen in Louisiana, when the voucher system started, many of the tax dollars went to backwoods schools that didn't have a curriculum, didn't have certified teachers. That's not an improvement in education, and all that's done in the name of choice. So when you give money to vouchers or when you give money to charters, you're taking money out of the public school system.
297-5633, if you'd like to join our conversation with Diane Ravitch. The New York Times book review of this book says Ravitch takes on the well-known private sector leaders and political officials, a fearless book, a manifesto, and a call to battle. Is it a battle?
It is indeed a battle. I know I hear from teachers every day because I have a very popular blog that's had over 14 million hits in the last 2 years, and teachers love my blog because I keep them informed about what's happening around the country. Everyone loves to see what's happening in Louisiana because I now refer to it as the Louisiana Circus, with the governor battling the state commissioner of education and the board of education. It is a battle. Teachers feel that they're under fire, that everybody just wants to tell them how to do their job because everyone's an expert. Everyone went to school, so they know how to fix things. I think teachers feel particularly upset about the fact that they're being compelled to do things that they don't believe are right. They've been, in many cases, they've been a successful teacher for many, many years. Their kids do well. They move on to good colleges, and then they get an evaluation telling them they're ineffective because the evaluation system is so flawed. So there are a lot of things that are just interfering with education, and it has to do with private entrepreneurs and government officials in Washington who are not educators themselves, sending out signals about how, or not signals, mandates from Washington about how to do everything.
The school system, the public school system in Louisiana, and in this community in particular, it's overwhelmingly African American. Poor kids who are going to public schools, maybe because they can't afford to go to private schools, and then the private schools are overwhelmingly white. Kids with means who have the ability to extricate themselves from what is deemed to be an inferior public school system. Is that perception, just for starters, is that perception wrong?
Well, I think it's an accurate perception, and it's an old story throughout the South, which is that schools in many places have resegregated because frequently whites don't want to go to schools that are where there's a black majority, and then the remaining whites Hopefully. So it's the old white flight story. We've seen this since the mid-60s when the courts began cracking down. I think that we have to do the best we can for the kids we have. Every child can learn. Every child can be educated. And I think that it would be better if fewer kids abandoned the public school system and stayed in it and made it better. I think that when public schools succeed, it's because the community supports them. It's because the parents and the students and the teachers are working together, and then the public schools get the support they need. When the whole white sector of the community abandons the public schools, it's not good for the public schools.
Diane, I've had a few people say, what about Common Core? I'm sure you knew this question was coming. Our governor, he was for it before he was against it. I gather he's in line with you now.
Well, I'm not a fan of Governor Jindal, and I've written quite a few pieces making that clear. And I was never for Common Core. I actually was skeptical, and sat, I watched it being developed, or I was briefed on it as it was being developed, and I wanted to just wait and see what rolled out. As it rolled out, I realized this curriculum, this national, they call it national standards, not a curriculum. It actually is a curriculum. But this national standards and national curriculum and national testing got foisted on the country before anybody knew what it was. And so my great objection to Common Core is that people like Governor Jindal and 40-some-odd other governors signed a memorandum of understanding without any public discussion and without having any educators intimately involved in the writing. And so there have been huge protests, not just from people on the right, but from people who are very progressive, and also from teachers who say, this is totally inappropriate for the children I teach, particularly in the early grades. So they didn't have any educators who had any experience with kindergarten, first, second, third grade, so they have totally ridiculous stuff in those early grades. And then they have all kinds of rules about, 70% of your reading in senior high school has to be informational text, not literature. Well, what business is it of theirs, these people who wrote the Common Core, whether you teach great literature or teach nonfiction essays? I mean, I think that should be left to the teacher. There's a lot in Common Core to dislike, and some people like it. If they want to use it, they should. I just don't think it should be mandated, and I do think it's going to go down as a national standard because states will either drop the testing, as many several states have done that already, and others are trying to get out of the Common Core itself. Oklahoma repealed the Common Core, and Arne Duncan punished them for it. While saying it was state-led, he punished Oklahoma. He said he was withdrawing their NCLB waiver, and I don't want to get too complicated here, but the No Child Left Behind law, which was George Bush's law and Ted Kennedy's law, said that by the year 2014, 100% of all students would be proficient, or your school's a failing school. That means that this year, every school in America is a failing school because there's no school district in the country that has 100% proficiency, and there's no nation in the world that has 100% proficiency. So Arne Duncan started handing out waivers and saying, well, you don't have to meet this unrealistic goal. And he punished Oklahoma. He said, you dropped the Common Core, I'm taking your waiver away.
All right. Veronica in Denham Springs. Good morning, Veronica. You're on with Diane Ravitch.
Hi. You mentioned that every child can learn and every child should be taught. But do you think it's an unfair comparison when we're compared to China, which they do not teach every child? It's pretty much an American ideal that we educate our masses, and we're compared to them, especially in math and science, and the majority of their children aren't in school. Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to have to ask Jim if he can repeat the question because I couldn't hear it clearly.
Well, the concept of preparing every child, she says the United States is judged against countries like China, and in Veronica's view and analysis, China has a different educational setup, standard, and approach than we have. So is this apples and oranges?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we've always had the ideal of educating everybody. China has, they're not selecting. What they do, though, is massive, massive rote memorization and test prep. And I just finished reading a new book that's coming out this month called Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Dragon? Why China Has the Best and the Worst Education System in the World. It's written by a Chinese-American scholar who says that you shouldn't be fooled by the test scores because whether you test in Shanghai or anywhere in China, you'll get high scores because the kids spend all their time preparing for the test, all their time is test prep. they spend sometimes 10 or 11 hours a day preparing to take tests, and this is all year round. We have a much more, I would say, the American concept of education has always been the idea of a rounded education, a balanced education, and we're trying, I think wrongly, to be more like the Chinese. We're not the Chinese. We're Americans. Our kids are engaged in sports. They have hobbies. They have plays, and they participate in band and chorus, and that's a much more balanced form of life. So I think that our strong point as Americans is not test scores. I don't think those international test scores mean very much, by the way. They don't predict anything whatever about the future. And I'll just mention something that's in my book. The first international test was given in 1964, and there were 12 nations that competed. We came in last. And in the 50 years after that test was given, we outperformed all the other 11 nations. So the test didn't predict anything about the future. We have always had low international test scores because I guess our kids just don't take it seriously. They say it doesn't count, it's not part of my grade, it's not part of getting into college, and they don't take it seriously.
All right, Veronica, thank you very much. Jennifer in Lafayette. Jennifer, you're on with Diane Ravitch. Hi, Jennifer.
Hey, good morning, Jim. Thanks for the program. It's a topic I'm interested in. I'm a graduate of Catholic schools and a former Catholic school teacher. I believe in Catholic schools and religious schools and non-religious private schools, but religious schools, because I think you can't, you know, I think there's something to be said for having the presence of the Lord in the classroom, but I'm not philosophically in favor of vouchers or in making tuition dollars tax-free. I think that's cherry-picking where your tax dollars go and getting financial credit where it doesn't belong. But I'm on the fence, I guess, about charter schools. It was actually through NPR that I learned that New Orleans has all charter schools now, and I was wondering if Ms. Ravitch might, if she knows anything in particular about the efficacy of charter schools in general, and if she knows anything about the performance of charter schools in New Orleans in particular. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jennifer. Diane?
Okay, there's a very good New Orleans-based website called Research on Reforms, which reports on things like the state scores of the charters. Most of the charters in New Orleans have been rated either D or F by the state of Louisiana. And the Recovery School District in New Orleans is considered one of the lowest-rated districts in the state of Louisiana. It's been hyped by the media as a miracle, but because so many millions have been poured into it, there's a lot of support from philanthropists, and they want to claim that all their money was well spent. But in fact, it is not a successful school system. Because there's no system there, they don't know how to meet problems as they arise. There was just an article in the Times-Picayune a couple weeks ago about a huge influx of kids from Latin America, and because there's no system, nobody knows where these kids ought to go or who has the capacity to teach them the right services, and it's all catch-as-catch-can. I would say that nationally, charters are underperforming. I just yesterday saw an article about how in the state of Texas, the public schools outperformed the charters. There was just a report from Ohio that charters are the overwhelming majority of failing schools in the states and the state of Ohio. And that's in state after state. You find that the public schools, despite the fact that everybody thinks the charter schools are superior, they're not. They do not get the same performance as the public schools.
The Nation says of Diane's book, and by the way, this was a bestseller in hardback, now available in paperback, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. The Nation, in its review, Ravitch's critique of the corporate reformers' manufactured agenda, along with the truly progressive alternative she offers, shows a way to begin the long haul toward improving democracy's classrooms. We're about to go to a break, but what can be done immediately in the near term to address the crisis in education in our country?
Well, short term is we should stop bashing our public schools, stop bashing the teachers, and invest in early childhood education, make sure that women have opportunity to have a medical exam when they're pregnant, and that they have the help that they need as young parents to bring their kids up so that they're healthy when they arrive in school. That would be immediate.
We shall return for a few more minutes with Diane Ravitch, her book Reign of Error. Also, we'll have the latest on the Senate race after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Diane Ravitch, who in Reign of Error, chapter by chapter, offers a plan for what she believes can be done to preserve and improve our public schools. Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning to your guests. Two quick questions. Here in Louisiana, we've wasted over a decade preparing public school kids to pass the LEAP exam while not preparing them for college, but the public schools get evaluated on kids going to college. The second question is, what do you think about Michael Milken and K-12 education? A lot of people don't know this unscrupulous fellow is behind K-12 education. I don't believe he's the only bad actor out there.
Michael Milken and the LEAP tests in Louisiana. Your thoughts, Diane Ravitch.
Well, you know, I think that kids today are over-tested. I think that if you too much time is spent with preparing to take tests and then taking the test and then telling the kids they're good, they're no good. I think it's good to have tests, but frankly, I believe very strongly that most of the tests should be written by the teachers because the teachers know what they taught them, and they can test them on whether they've learned it or not and do something about it right away. I think the focus in Louisiana has, as everywhere else, because of No Child Left Behind, this federal law, has been too much on standardized testing. And it's enriched the testing industry, but it has not done much to actually improve education.
And Michael Milken?
Well, Michael Milken, I think, is he has this company, K-12, which is the virtual charter school. It is a ripoff. It's the closest thing to a Ponzi scheme that I've seen in education. He's making millions and millions and millions of dollars, and the academic results of Michael Milken's K-12 charter academies are abysmal. They have a huge dropout rate. The kids have low test scores and abysmal graduation rates.
Well, Diane, it's always good to talk with you, and hope you'll be in Louisiana again soon.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure. Thanks.
And certainly a compelling book, Reign of Error, from Diane Ravitch. Now in studio, one Scott Wilfong. He is a Republican political consultant who shoots from the lip as he sees it, and we're 7 weeks and one day away from Election Day, as in 50 days from today. We will be casting ballots in the U.S. Senate election and in others, including in this area, the 6th District Congressional election. And some, of course, are in Cedric Richmond's 2nd District, some right in the heart of Baton Rouge, like Joe Delpit on Iowa Street. He'll be voting in the 2nd District. Let's start with that one, Scott. What about this? The fact that much of Baton Rouge is now in the 2nd Congressional District, is Billy Nungesser, the Billy Sr. used to say, is that fair pool?
It's probably not, but it's just a reflection of how the process works. You know, quite honestly, the areas like in St. Bernard and all that normally would have been geographically grouped with the 2nd, went to the legislature and said, we don't want to be in this district. And they had a little more clout than the Baton Rouge delegation did, and so that's how it works. I mean, you know, it's pretty much accepted that we need to have a certain number of minority districts, and you have to get
well,
to
it,
them.
It would be a minority district regardless.
It would, you know, but I remember when I lived in Ruston, at one time, Cleo Fields was my congressman.
That's right.
From Baton Rouge.
Well, the Justice Department shut that one down, though.
They did, and that was the definition.
And they should shut this one down, but they didn't.
They didn't, and, you know, I think that it's just a matter of who's screaming the loudest, and quite honestly, I don't think there's a lot of blowback from it right now. So it's wrong, though. It is wrong in principle, I agree.
But and I agree with those who say that Edwin Edwards' chances of winning in the 6th District are very remote because the numbers just aren't there for him. But I do think if it were configured in the old way, he'd have a fighting chance.
He would. And as we've said before, I think on the show, in the 5th District, he would have had a better chance.
He would have. But he lives in the greater Baton Rouge area, and he decided to run where he lives. But when you're running for Congress, you don't have to.
You don't. Just a resident of the state. I think we just learned that you have to be an inhabitant of the state on the day you are elected.
Well,
that's why Mary Landrieu was okay.
We will talk about that. But yesterday, the Advocate, in previewing the Senate race, has the three smiling faces of Mary Landrieu, Bill Cassidy, and Rob Manus, three very attractive candidates. And Mary Landrieu's caption reads, a three-term Senate incumbent, her biggest liability is the D after her name. And under Bill Cassidy, it says a three-term House incumbent, his biggest asset is the R
after his name? Is it going to come down to that?
Well, I think it is. You know, anytime you have an unpopular president, which you certainly do right now, you're running on his, running on his ticket, so to speak. But, Landry's the charter flight thing has certainly hurt her. I would say a week ago, I would have said, you just can't know. It's no better than 50-50 either way. But I would, now, of course, I'm a little biased, but I do think Cassidy has a slight edge. I think if the election were held today, you'd see a runoff. Certainly with him and Landrieu, and then in a December runoff, you'd certainly give the edge to the Republican.
Landrieu has been a much more visible person on the campaign trail. Bill Cassidy is running a campaign largely on television, some radio, and selected interviews. He has not been on this show. He's not gone before the press club, and he, to this point, has not engaged in a full-force debate and indicates that he will do one or two before the finish line 50 days away. And he has areas where he could attack Senator Landrieu, no doubt about it. He's got an 18-year record of hers that he could attack. And he's also got this, that Senator Landrieu last Friday got ahead of the story, and at least tried to. She released a press message saying, as promised, U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu released a full and complete review of the flights in question, her campaign flights. Errors were found to have been reported to the Senate Ethics Committee and fully repaid by Senator Landrieu's campaign at $33,727.02. Those are for flights that she charged to the taxpayers that she later found out, she said, improperly were charged to us, and so she's repaid it. Now, Bill Cassidy today sends out a press release saying, today, Congressman Bill Cassidy announced the introduction of a resolution to require both members of the U.S. House and U.S. Senate to report when congressional funds are used for private chartered planes. Information, including the purpose of the flight and the cost to taxpayers, must be reported within 30 days of the flight. Is this a one- or two-day story, or will this one be lingering and through December?
Well, I think what you see here is a good example of why Republicans tend to lose the message debates on any of these type issues. And I'm not trying to criticize Bill. I'm certainly for him. But Landrieu's done a wonderful job of making this a dollars and cents issue. You know, we made a mistake. We repaid it. It's a bad bookkeeping error. Instead of talking about what it really is, which is, it's poor judgment. It's certainly a senator that didn't run her office, that didn't think about when you hop on a charter plane at what is it, $700-$800 an hour, probably more. I'm not a pilot, but you have to, at some point, the thought has to go through your mind, who's paying for this? And over 14 years, the thought never crossed her mind, maybe we ought to check on that. Maybe we ought to check in, but here Congressman Cassidy comes out with the resolution to talk about more financial regulation, more dollars and cents. It's not something that voters are going to really clam on to. But if you start talking about Landrieu, taking advantage of the taxpayers, just, getting her free trips, courtesy of John Q. Taxpayer. That's how you win the message battle, and I hate to see it going down this route where it's just about $33,781.10. That's not going to make a difference, I don't think, in this race. You have to make it about more than just the money.
I think you make some good points, and I think the senator should not only have paid the money back, but she should have paid with interest.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But my guess is that if you were to check David Vitter, maybe even Bill Cassidy, at one time or another, they may have done the same thing. And if they have not, they need to also release their flight records.
And that may be why you're seeing it go down this path instead of trying to make it a moral issue, a judgment issue. Maybe they know that in their own – maybe they're afraid to look into their own records, it happens. I don't know if you saw the article about the new private book of rules that's now come out that's not – even the Library of Congress doesn't have a copy of. That's going to get some traction in the next few weeks about all these special rules that senators have that no one ever knew about. So it could be that there's a lot – the glass houses type analogy.
All right. 297-5633 for Scott Wilfong. Frank Barnett is producing Inkster Show at WRKF.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show as well. A question from Louie. He asks about Rob Manus, the other guy in the race who is mounting a vigorous campaign, is no joke, and he presumably is a thorn in the side of Cassidy, but his inclusion, writes Louis, and Louis may be onto something here, probably ensures a runoff in December.
It probably does, which is a good thing. It's interesting. I'm glad that question got asked because it points to a problem that we have with the part with our state party, and that is that in the last week I've had three friends email me about, you know, can Cassidy do this, and what about Manus? What about is it okay to vote for this other guy? We're 50 days from the election. You know, 8 months ago, if that would have been the question and there had been these conservatives looking at another candidate, you know, that would have been the appropriate time. And what it really shows to me is the need for a closed primary system. The party really needs an opportunity to hash out our differences, let our people vote for who they want to vote for, and one person's going to emerge, and then we can all get behind them. If we'd have had a party primary in May, June, whatever, we would have either Manus or Cassidy right now. There'd be no question about who we're all behind. We would have had our opportunity to campaign for our guy. But instead, here we are. I mean, I'm glad people are engaged and getting engaged, but 50 days out is not the time to start wondering which one you're going to pick.
Another question. Why hasn't Bobby Jindal, our governor, endorsed Bill Cassidy?
There's a political answer, and then there's another political answer.
Okay, let's hear both.
I think Bobby is trying to stay away from endorsement. I think early in his term as governor, he had some bad endorsements. See, he endorsed some losers. He doesn't want to go down that path. The other, I think, more telling reason is that the Cassidy campaign is made up largely of David Vitter staffers. And Bobby Jindal and David Vitter are probably the two biggest political enemies in the state.
That's the untold story. They don't like each other.
They don't like each other. Quite honestly, a lot of people don't like Senator Vitter. He's effective as a senator, but back to his days in the legislature, he certainly did things his own way and didn't make a lot of friends. And so I think that's probably the biggest reason.
Well, it'll be fascinating to see if it goes to a runoff, as it probably will. Mm-hmm. Will William Morgan Cassidy get the endorsement of Governor Bobby Jindal at that point? I would say he probably will at that point.
Yeah, I think then you have the cover, especially from a governor who's obviously running for president. You know, he's going to need to be the party guy and show his support and hopefully raise money and do whatever he can do. You know, I think at that point, though, it's also going to depend on what the numbers are after November 4th in the U.S. Senate. If it's 50-49, or I guess it'd need to be 50-49 Republican with that seat on the line, because if it's 50-50, then...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So
297-5633 for Scott Wilfong. And here's a question that is not related to the Senate race, but... it's a good one. Bobby Jindal, a few weeks ago, went to the Mexican border to discourage illegal immigration and these people coming to Louisiana. The question is, why wasn't he focusing on illegal immigration of Scott Rogers?
I was not expecting the rest of that question. I was thinking more like the Bayou Corn sinkhole or something
like that.
Well,
Scott Rogers, this is no joke. He was in our midst contaminating the countryside of St. Gabriel, and Governor Jindal didn't say a word about
him. In 2010, when Jay Darden was running for lieutenant governor, and you had all the candidates running for lieutenant governor for the open seat after Mitch Landry won, Scott Rogers moderated a debate in Baton Rouge, but between those candidates.
For the lieutenant governor.
For the lieutenant governor's
race.
Yeah,
and I remember a few years ago, Scott, they had the bowling event down at the River Center, and I'm in one lane, and Kip Holden's in another lane, and Joe Oliva's in another lane, and the voice calling the action was Scott Rogers.
That's scary.
Jim on I-10. Jim, good morning.
Hello, guys. How you doing?
Fine.
I wanted to ask what our boy from the Republican Party thinks about the vote on Citizens United. And before he answers that question, let me tell him that any intellectual or political argument about free speech is nothing more than deception.
The election or the Supreme Court ruling?
The vote by the Republican Senate, they voted almost en masse and maybe unanimously to preserve the Citizens United decision. There's some, of course, some Democrats are trying to overturn that through congressional lawmaking.
Well, obviously I'm going to come down on the side of the Citizens United case. You know, I think it free speech, you have to believe in free speech for everyone, not just for your points of view. And you know, I think the Supreme said that corporations are persons under the law with free speech rights. And I think that's what we believe. No one wants their speech infringed upon. And until it doesn't serve their interests. And I think that's where you are. I think the Republicans are – I'm surprised if they – I didn't see that vote, but I'm surprised if they voted completely unanimous on that because
– Well, more money in campaigns generally means more money for Republicans. Republicans are the party, generally speaking, of corporate America. And corporate America has more funds available for campaigns than other sources. But that said – President Obama certainly hasn't had difficulty raising money.
I was going to say Wall Street loves Obama because he's pumping billions every month into the market.
Look at what the market's done.
Well, it's because of
I bet you're doing very well, Scott.
Well, I my investments are a little more different than most, I don't think that in 20 years ago that probably was the case that corporate America was 80% behind Republicans, but you've seen that change over the last few years, so. I think Citizens United was a landmark. It certainly was a landmark case. I think it will alter the landscape of the Congress, but it'll take mm-hmm. time to do that.
The residency question that didn't go very far with Senator Landrieu. It appears that she's home free on that one. Was that a tempest in a teapot?
Well, I thought it was brilliant. Actually, I'm going to give credit to our chairman, and the party for engaging in that, even though by the letter of the law, she was covered. Yes, the Constitution says you have to be an inhabitant of the state. But look at the time that she was off message defending that. And that's even if you know you're right and you know you're going to win, is that really an argument you want to be making to the voters? Yeah, I live here. I'm here. I sleep in mommy's mm-hmm. house once or twice a month every week. The rest of the time I'm in daddy's house.
Which
she owns a 12th of or something. I mean,
owns 20%.
20%. I mean, I'll tell you this: she wasn't in the day she had to defend that suit. She wasn't in Bastrop or Ringgold or Morganza campaigning. Mm-hmm. She was doing something else. So it was, and it made front page news. And she had to tell people why she lives in Washington. She supposedly wants to represent here, but she owns a $2 million home in D.C. and sleeps in Dad's house every so often.
Well, 4301 South Pryor Street, New Orleans, same address she gave when she was attending Louisiana State University. William Morgan Cassidy was on campus at the same time. They might have rubbed shoulders. he was at 3844 Drusilla when he was in school. And they're colliding in the U.S. Senate election. Bill Cassidy, a newcomer to politics who once supported Mary Landrieu, backed her in 2002 when he had three Republicans to choose from, and Tony Perkins, John Cooksey, and Susie Terrell. Bill Cassidy was a Landrieu supporter. What happened to him? We'll talk more with Scott Rogers. Scott Wilfong in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Coming in short order, we're slated to hear from Lisa Guernsey. Her book is Screen Time, How Electronic Media, From Baby Videos to Educational Software, Affects Your Young Child. A few more minutes with Scott Wilfong. Sorry I called you bad name a few moments ago, but Scott takes it in stride, as he always does. He's gotten on this show a few times and has gotten some pointed questions and answered them as best he could. I had Sally Nungesser with us. She was a guest a few weeks ago and said that she thought Cassidy would get about 54% in the runoff. She's predicting a rout. What do you think?
I think part of that's going to be how many congressional races. I mean, the 5th District should go to a runoff. The 6th District will go to a runoff. If the 4th and the 3rd are, it's possible. I would probably predict more like 52-48, but it just depends on the runoffs around the state and how much Democrat vote can be turned out.
I checked the 2002 election, and within a few thousand votes, people voted in the same number in December as they did in November. And there were not all these congressional races either. So I don't think turnout may be as big a factor as many think it will. I know some people were saying, in fact, this guy, Daryl Glasscock, said it'd be half in December. It's not going to be half. Yeah. It's going to be about 100% of what it is in November. Now, it'll be different voters in some cases.
Right.
But it shapes up as a real tight race either way. I think 52-48 may be ambitious for either candidate.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the difference this year, you might have noticed, it's like the most races we've had on a ballot in Louisiana in something like 40 years. You've got just all the judge. It just in one of those years where all the judges, district attorneys, everybody like that is up. So you're going to have, for instance, you'll have a judge runoff in Livingston Parish, in Tangipahoa Parish. You know, all these places around the state where you're going to have local races turning out voters. It could very well be the same number turnout in December as in November. The difference is going to be who they are. It won't be the same electorate. That's going to be the difference.
Kirsten on Government Street writes, what does Scott say about Governor Jindal's out-of-state trips that have cost Louisiana taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen his records. I don't know who's paying for what. I'm assuming the campaign is paying for his flights
paying
to Iowa.
Paying for some of it, but when the state troopers go with him, all that stuff, I think, is taken care of by us.
It is.
And,
you know, the same way when, you know, President Obama goes on vacation and plays golf in the middle of a terrorist crisis. You know, we have to have Secret Service and, you know, all this. It's what it is with politicians, especially executive officers. They've got to have security. They're going to cost money. You know, in the end, I guess, you know, it's not illegal. There's certainly nothing, at least not what Jindal's doing, certainly not. And, you know, voters will have their opportunity to express their displeasure with him if they want to.
Okay, finally, for Scott, we're getting off on these peripheral issues that really, when it comes down to it, as far as the stability of the country and the stability of the electorate in Louisiana, they amount to very little. What are the issues, or what is an issue in the next 50 days that may define the differences between Landrieu, Cassidy, and Manus?
Well, I do think that probably the residency thing is the most politically effective one. And if I were Cassidy, that's what I would make an issue of. Technically, Mary can run. She certainly will be a resident on the day of the election. But again, I think that's the one that'll ring home with that'll resonate with voters. You know, if you're not. In fact, the commercial that just came out with the mayor of D.C. calling Landrieu the senator for
the 51st
state.
So you think that is the major issue?
I don't know that it's major, but I think it's the one in a close race that can tip the balance. Mm-hmm. I think if you get a lot of these rural white Democrats thinking that Landrieu does not really live here and doesn't want to live here, and in fact she'd rather fight for Washington, D.C. than fight for Louisiana, that's when people do say, you know, I've been with you for 18 years. I think we're going to make a change. And you only need a few of those voters around the state in an election like this to really tip the balance. I mean, you know, her poll numbers are clear. She's in the low to mid 40s. She cannot afford to lose too many more folks. And I think that's it's not a big national issue, a national security issue, but it is something that I think will turn voters off.
I'm surprised that she has not countered with a spot showing Congressman Cassidy's million-dollar home at 3115 Dalrymple, and saying that this was built for Congressman Cassidy on the backs of public health care. He was a doctor at Earl K. Long, and now he's against public health care for other people.
But again, that's an issue that has to be explained. I can take that and say, hey, both candidates have million-dollar homes. One sits in Baton Rouge. One sits in Washington, D.C.
Larry at Cortana. Please be brief, Larry. You're on with Scott.
Thank you, Jim. Scott, I'm concerned about this. We're not having the president to be our senator. Why do Republicans keep running against the president rather than mayor and what have you? And what are the doctor going to give to the people, to what's called, so the voters can make up their mind who to vote for?
All right. What about running against the president rather than running against the candidate? It worked pretty well for David Vitter when he was running against Charlie Malanson.
It did, and if you if Mary Landrieu had an independent streak about her and didn't vote with the president over 90% of the time, I would say that's a good issue. But the fact is, she is a rubber stamp from President Obama. Every time he needs a major vote, including Obamacare, she's there for him. So I think that's a perfect issue to frame is, do you want another senator who's going to vote 90% of the time with the president, or do you want someone that's going to vote at least independent or the other way? And I think most voters don't like Obama in this state.
All right. Now, Rocky asked, and I'll leave it with this, but he asked a question. He says, Scott, have you ever been convicted of violating ethics laws?
No, I have not.
No. There was an investigation, but you were...
There was, but I was cleared entirely.
Well, yes. Thank you for coming in. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Scott. Jim. Appreciate it.
297-5633 is your number. Our guest is Lisa Guernsey. She's director of the Early Education Initiative at the New America Foundation. She's coming this way, and we'll talk about her appearance in our community, a mother of two young daughters. She has wondered about the influence that television and computer use are having on their development and has written about it in Screen Time. Good morning, Lisa.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Doing well. Well, why are electronic media a threat to the fabric of our society?
Well, actually, I started working on this book, Screen Time, because I thought that might be the case. But in fact, after looking at the research for many years and going to developmental psych labs around the country, I found that it really is not a threat so much as something we just need to understand much better. So the ultimate takeaway is that we need to be thinking much more about just the quantity of time children are spending with TV or with computers or smartphones, but instead look deeply at what they're doing when they're watching and how they're learning from what they're experiencing.
You examine how parents, teachers, others can rethink technology and help children learn to read in a digital age. Are there some possibilities that are now available that were not there when people like yours truly were growing up?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the kind of surprising findings in my research and that of many others. I've been doing a project for the past 2 years with a firm in New York called the Joan Ganz Cooney Center at Sesame Workshop, and we've been exploring how everything from text messaging to videos on smartphones might help spark new conversations between parents and children that build language skills that ultimately are the building blocks for being strong readers. So there are a lot of new ways of thinking about technology that don't have to feel like threats.
Lisa Guernsey is the guest, author, journalist, and early education advocate. She writes articles on technology and education for the New York Times and for other publications. And she will be at the Crown Plaza this Thursday at 4:30, check-in 4 o'clock. And if you'd like to participate in this event or be a present when she speaks, 225-293-3345. That's 225-293-3345. Her book is Screen Time. So how are your children developing with all these possibilities in their midst that are tantalizing?
Yeah, it's a conundrum, actually, and I think any parent today can probably relate to the fact that, you know, they're just awash in media, and as parents, it can feel like almost too much. I had the privilege, really, in working on this book of starting to recognize how much my own interactions with them matter and the way I thought about the way they use technology mattered. So instead of just simply handing them the phone in the back of the seat of the car and say, okay, just, you know, do whatever, I'm now recognizing that there are chances to have new conversations with my children because of the fun things that they might be seeing, or there's chances to kind of explain to them why I want to have them turn it off for a while and why we need to look out the window and talk about what we see on the playground. So it's what I call it is the three C's, that we need to be thinking not just about quantity, but also the content on the screen, the context, the way we're talking to our children and using these devices with them. And then the third C is child, your individual child and his needs or her needs Every kid is so different, and we can't just have a blanket rule or statement about how they should be using technology. We have to really just know our kids.
How do we, as a people, how do we stop worrying about overstimulation?
I think that there are times where we, even as adults, have to kind of look up and think about how much is coming in at us and our adult brains, and then try. And this can be hard at first. You know, putting yourself in the mind of a child is not always so easy. But trying to think back to how much was coming at you when you were, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old. Hard to remember back much younger than that, of course. And if we can tune into what our kids are feeling and thinking and be more present for them, even hearing what their questions are, that can help us zoom in on things that they want to focus on instead of feeling like we're just flying around in a sea of stimulation out there.
Despite all these technological wonders that are available, you write in your book, Lisa, that conversing with young children, even when they are infants, is important.
It is critical, absolutely. And this is, to me, this was the good news as a parent. I was like, oh, wait, it's not just about, like, reading books to kids, which is wonderful and absolutely important, but it's just simply talking to them about what you see in the world and hearing their questions and then responding to those in a way that shows that you're interested in what they're interested in. And we have learned from a lot of new brain science as well as simply from language development and speech therapists over the years that back and forth conversation, that, you know, serve and return like in a ping pong match, that really helps to build children's brains, and that'll be really critical for their reading skills later on. So that was a good message. Mm-hmm. I felt as a parent like, hey, I can do that. I can talk with my children. It's fun to talk with my kids.
The Academic Distinction Fund is the group that is responsible for bringing Lisa to our community later this week on Thursday, and her book is Screen Time, How Electronic Media, From Baby Videos to Educational Software, Affects Your Young Child. And I guess the overriding message is that if it is used in the right way, these can be far more helpful than hurtful.
Yes, I don't know if I'd say far more. I think that we do really need to watch out for things that can be of harm and tune into that. But I do think we can't demonize technology anymore. It's in our lives, and we need to be more thoughtful and intentional about using it and make some distinctions between educational media and that that's just background TV mm-hmm. and that might be having some harm.
Here's a question from a listener, and you do address it in the book about videos and graphic nature and which videos are too scary for children.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know?
Exactly. That was one chapter in the book that was really tough because the research is not solid on this. But what I did find in talking to both parents and experts is that children may be much more upset by what they see than we realize. And it's harder, especially in those young ages, 3, 4, 5 years old, for them to make distinctions between what's real and what's not. So simply telling a child, you shouldn't be scared, this isn't real, that doesn't really register with them. So instead, we need to be there for kids when they're seeing something upsetting, turn it off, pause, give them a chance to kind of redirect, give them something comforting, and kind of be more alert when we're taking them to the movies or having them kind of sit down with a whole group of people watching something that might be made more for adults or teenagers. Be alert to how they're feeling and reacting.
At what age should children be provided the opportunity to embrace this technological world that we're in?
This is an area of major debate, actually. The age of 2 is one that has a lot of kind of discussion and dissension around it because there are some who believe that children really can't possibly learn from any kind of electronic media before age 2 and that maybe there's some chance for them after that. I wish I could tell you that there is a hard and fast rule there, but the research isn't as clear as you might think. It is true, however, that we don't have a lot of evidence of children learning just simply by themselves by watching screens before age 2, that they really need mom or dad or their caregivers, their grandparents next to them to help them interpret and see, pointing at things, talking about them, relating them to the real world, so that those kind of interactions are the primary kind of interactions children are having. before age two, and then maybe after that, we learn more about how more direct media experiences are able to be learned from in children at, say, 2.5 and 3 and 4 years of age.
When does the television come on, and when does it go off?
This was definitely a question in our household when I was raising our babies, because for a while I kind of had it on a lot of the time. I, as a mom, I wanted it there for comfort. I needed to kind of feel like I was in touch with the world. But I found that having a background that background TV, that noise there, could in fact have a negative impact on my children's language development. And so I started to make sure that I was turning it off when I wasn't really needing to listen to it. And that allowed me some more chance to talk with my children and just hear when they were upset, or have a chance to hear when they were giggling and laughing and pointing at something that they wanted to talk about.
The book is Screen Time, originally published as Into the Minds of Babies, from Lisa Guernsey, and she'll be in Baton Rouge at the Crown Plaza, 4:30 Thursday. And if you'd like more information, 293-3345, 225-293-3345 to register. Thank you, Lisa.
Looking forward to it. Thanks so much, Jim.
Have a good trip. And we shall return tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.